given that Vancouver is, you know, the one big city in Canada that makes Toronto seem affordable and like we have our shit together when it comes to housing. Of course, today's housing crises are the result of policies of many successive governments over decades, and there's, you know, reason to hope that the NDP is gradually making this BC situation less bad than it might otherwise be.
I mean, can I just jump in there and say that she's wrong about the BC NDP? First off, you should never congratulate anybody in BC for developing real estate. It's like breathing here. But, you know, I've talked to people who work in like supportive housing and rental housing, like, and they told me that the BC NDP has put a freeze on their funding for the next 3 years. So in other words, like these people who provide that emergency support, including for native housing, are having to dig into their own savings, if they have it, in order to provide basic maintenance. And they're looking at this going forward for the next several years. So maybe on the face of it, the BC NDP might be doing something that from a distance looks really progressive. But here on the ground, what the result is that people who live in rat-infested hotels are going to have to deal with more rats for the next several years. And the people who are dealing with like mildewy hotels better get used to rats.
Things often tend to look more progressive from a distance. So maybe that's why Canada has such relatively high stature among the American progressives.
I mean, it's super underreported. I don't know if anyone's actually written anything about it, but if you talk to people on the ground who are doing that housing, they're saying that the NDP freeze is hugely affecting them.
So perhaps the NDP government in BC, though I'm sure it's doing things, may be doing things that are in some ways better than the federal Liberal government or the Ontario Conservative government, may not be altogether or comprehensively laudatory. One government in Canada that Bell didn't mention in her op-ed, one that is doing interesting and kind of exciting things with housing, is the Squamish Nation in British Columbia. As Michelle Cisa put it in an article in Maclean's just a couple weeks ago, Vancouver's new mega development is big, ambitious, and undeniably Indigenous. In BC, Indigenous nations are reclaiming power and wealth for their own citizens, no matter what the neighbors think. Sanok is going to be, when it's finished, I believe the densest development in Canada. It's going to have 6,000 rental units spread across 11 towers, all concentrated in this relatively small footprint at the southern edge of the Burrard Bridge. It's land that's not part of the city of Vancouver in the legal or technical sense, but it is in the practical sense. It was land that the Squamish were gradually and then abruptly forcefully expelled from a little over 100 years ago, in which through decades and court challenges eventually won back and have now decided to take advantage of the fact that city laws, zoning laws, those kinds of rules don't apply in order to build what one, from a certain perspective, is the best case scenario, a bunch of dense high-rise towers. Robert, I understand you're fairly familiar with this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from a Vancouver area First Nation, and I mean, I'm friends with the people who are building it. So I'm very familiar with Sanok. It's this huge development taking place around the Burrard Bridge right next to downtown, just a short two-minute water taxi ride away. For every First Nations person, I guess, in the region, it's kind of the big signature piece that we're all looking to. It has the potential of being like downtown native Vancouver.
And I understand, like, are you thinking of moving there?
I think every single native person in the city would love to live on an oceanfront penthouse with artificially low rents and no tax. It is kind of appealing.
There's something uncommonly utopian. This is sort of like watching a piece of solutions journalism rise many stories into the sky directly in front of you. It sounds good, too good to be true. And is it weird that it's something that has gotten national media attention, but not like wild national media attention in the way that, you know, any given residential development doesn't tend to be a national news story. But it is such a fascinating and unusual thing that would seem so, in many ways, inconceivable in so much of the country.
Yeah, no, I can see how it's inconceivable elsewhere. But, I mean, Vancouver, you remember, is full of reserves, like right in the city. Not just that one. There's another reserve in the south of the city. And this is unique only in scale. But if you look across the region, there are tons of similar developments. You know, there was the Liberals' rapid housing initiative led to a whole bunch of new condo towers being built, including in Squamish, including my own First Nation, and they're sprouting up all over the region. We just heard of Cowichan building this giant new electric car battery factory. You know, there's another nation nearby that built a port. And I mean, it's just part of the culture of Salish people, which of whom, you know, Squamish is a part, my nation is a part, to be really business orientated. we're basically, you know, there's like 50 different Salish nations, but each of them is a tiny, tiny little Dubai in waiting. And that's kind of how you should really look at Squamish. So this development is the first, but it's one of three huge developments that they're building. And this isn't even the biggest one. Our people have always been a very urban people.
Mm-hmm.
If you read all the early explorers when they're coming here, they're talking about passing large villages full of apartment buildings, some 400, 500 meters long or something like that, each full of little apartments full of tons and tons and tons of people closely packed together. We've had to be that way because Vancouver geography has always been Vancouver geography. It's hilly. There's a tidal area. There's not a lot of land to build on.
The fifth episode of CBC's Land Back podcast, hosted by Angela Sterrett, not to be confused with Canada Land's Canada Land Back podcast, concerned this development. Back in December 2022, the episode called A Village Burned. And the center of the episode is this interview with a former longtime Vancouver City Councillor and elder statesman, Gordon Price, who, in my understanding, like fraternal listeners, he was sort of the Kyle Ray of Vancouver. And he becomes a little, maybe a little bluntly honest, believing that the development is itself a form of retribution.
Look, I'll say it. It's basically, you f***ed us, now we f*** you. That's no basis for reconciliation. That's not going to work.
But
that's
is it really
awful.
We f***ed you, though, when they're supplying housing for thousands of people?
Yeah,
is that really f***ed you, though?
No, it's about democratic accountability.
Right,
they decide.
So it's a matter of who's got the power.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Bingo.
How would you say it's been discussed in Vancouver media? Because when it gets here, it's usually, you know, is in the terms of like solutions journalism is already being discussed very much in the land back context. But I imagine Vancouver media, as all local media is, probably has maybe a more parochial element to it.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about different voices. There's a huge NIMBY factor in that area. Where they're building Snock is Kitts Point. And Kitts Point is rich. It's like the rich part of Richville. It's beautiful, huge beachfront houses. And it's people who all bought cheap after the land was seized from the Squamish or whose grandparents did and they inherited it. And those places are all like $4 or $5 million, right? I recently went to that neighborhood and I bought a Crousette from a rich person in a basement suite there. The level of wealth there is just hilarious. God, I dated someone who lived in the neighborhood. And again, they lived in half of a condo there, just to show you how rich it was. And I was looking at the art on the walls, and it was the same art I was studying in Canadian art history class in college, like the original versions of it. I'm like, that looks so familiar. It makes Yorkville or Rosedale in Toronto look poor. So those people obviously don't want other people in the neighborhood. And it's like, that neighborhood is like a white reserve, right? Vancouver is not a very white city. It's like maybe 40% white or something like that, maybe 45. But that neighborhood is, I don't know the exact demographics of it, but if you walk down the street, it's pretty sunscreen using. I just don't think they want those neighbors in there. But, you know, they're all progressive and liberals. So they're not going to say it outright. So the opposition there has been really fierce. But the opposition has all been couched in these environmental terms. The second angle is they're talking about how this isn't really the Squamish Nation. This is a big real estate development that's tricked the Squamish into giving up their land for them, as if the Squamish could be tricked by real estate developers.
Yeah, and it is in collaboration with West Bank, but yeah, no, exactly.
I mean, these are sophisticated business people. This isn't the only Indigenous skyscraper the Squamish built. There's another one across the bridge, just across from Vancouver, that you go to now. There's Indigenous office towers built by the Squamish. And then the last kind is just clueless-ass old people who are just antique racists, who say stuff like, there was one counselor saying, this isn't in a very Indigenous way of building. Others saying, you know, you need to build this out of wood if you want it to be Indigenous. Or I can't imagine Native people living together in a great big building. That doesn't sound very Native. They're appealing to like this story time Natives as squirrel thing that a lot of like really old people believe.
Now, the twist on this, the part that sort of takes it from being, oh, this is a neat thing that I want to learn more about to, let's talk about this on Shortcuts, is how just in the past few months, it's something that libertarians and right-wingers the world over have been getting kind of excited about. Like, not like, you know, frenzied about, but it's been getting noticed, and just as how here it's often the subject of more left-leaning solutions journalism. There have been a number of stories just in the past few months where various libertarian publications and think tanks have been getting pretty enthusiastic. So like Reason magazine, for example, which, you know, the American libertarian thing describes itself as, you know, free minds and free markets. And it's actually specifically a semi-autonomous libertarian law professor blog underneath the Reason banner called the Volokh Conspiracy. But they were to post called Canadian Indigenous Nations Use Exemptions from Zoning Rules to Build Affordable High-Rise Housing by Ilya Somin, who's a professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University and author of the book Democracy and Political Ignorance, Why Smaller Government is Smarter. There's also been Learn Liberty, website by Students for Liberty, which is like a transnational campus libertarian organization. The story, A New Vancouver Development Shows What's Possible When Housing is Deregulated, by Russell Coates, who's a Northern Irish guy, who's the editor-in-chief of Learn Liberty, and whose most recent two blog posts there are Five People Influenced by Ayn Rand and Anthem, A Gateway to the Genius of Ayn Rand. The Post in Wellington, New Zealand, had a couple op-eds, actually. New localist approach can be more responsive to local needs, and a Canadian housing development shows how the value of Indigenous land can be unlocked, both by Eric Crampton, who's the chief economist of the New Zealand Initiative, which is a right-wing think tank that's basically their version of the Fraser Institute, and they're actually both part of the same, like, global right-wing think tank network. So, Robert, why do you think libertarians have seeming to be embracing this? I don't know, is this surprising at all, or is it just interesting?
Okay, well, I'm in two minds about it. I'm sort of like a longstanding believer that we need a conservative Indigenous policy, that there is a place for like right-wing people in this country to have a pro-Indigenous policy that is framed in their terms. And the way they're framing this is kind of in that way from a conservative perspective. This seems like a great thing. It's pro-business. It's low red tape from their misperception of it. If you want to see a city without zoning, go to Dallas. Mm-hmm. But don't go to Res. I've sat on a Res lands board, and the regulation process there, it might be a little bit faster than a city because you're dealing with fewer people, but it's just as paperwork inducing and onerous and full of long speeches from locals coming to yell at you randomly about whatever. You know, I mean, I loved that show Parks and Recreation, and working on a native lands board was like Parks and Recreation, like with just the public ass meetings going on forever. That's what native planning is. It's not no zoning. There's zoning. There's a land use policy that the Squamish have, and they have public meetings. They have votes on all these things. That's a huge misunderstanding.
No, it is interesting how in some ways they seem to be excited about is, you know, the lack of zoning regulation on this property, that on this piece of land that basically the nation can build whatever, really relatively speaking. But it also seems like they to themselves are projecting something onto Indigenous governance that is, you know, not reflective of the complex reality, projecting sort of their libertarian ideals and what they would like to see and just trying to pull that out of it. Whereas once again, it's more complicated than either version.
Well, I mean, Salish culture, you could almost call it anarcho-capitalist and historically. So I could see why it would appeal to them, but we're operating in a federal land use planning framework from the First Nations Land Management Act that imposes really, really strict and intense rules. So we're following federal government rules, you know, the dreaded Trudeau. I mean, those are the rules that we're under. Yeah, we have our own like versions of it, but it's not strictly our process here that we're looking at. You know, the New Zealand thing, I mean, all these right-wingers are approaching it from their own myopic little views and everything, but the New Zealand one is the worst of all, because New Zealand's new government has this really powerful minority party in the coalition. It's called ACT, and it's a libertarian party, and they're constantly attacking Indigenous people in the country. They just, like, wiped out the health authority. They're, you know, going after universities. They're doing all, like, the fringe right-wing stuff to roll back Maori rights. So it's kind of gross that our nations are being held up as like positive examples for these people, because, I mean, yeah, we're doing this ourselves, but there's still, everything they're killing we have here. New Zealand has long been like this model of like how you could have actual reconciliation, and they're killing all of it And yeah, I don't want our nations to be helpful in that at all.
Yeah.
Even rhetorically.
The New Zealand Initiative, the organization of which that Eric Crampton is the chief economist of. New Zealand is not the biggest country, so there aren't too many right-wing think tanks, but it's one of the organizations that is definitely chiefly credited with advancing the policies that we're seeing now that are rolling back a whole bunch of things in New Zealand, but most prominently, the penetration into all parts of society and government.
Well, like the Maori language and the Maori presence has been there in all parts of government, and they're specifically like targeting it. Like they're not lying about it. They're not hiding it. They're saying we're getting rid of this. And they're using like that language that you see from the extreme right here, saying, you know, this is race-based laws. We want one set of laws for everybody, that kind of stuff, which, I mean, in a unitary state like New Zealand, maybe that goes far, but in a federal state like Canada, it's kind of dumb, like transparently dumb.
Oh, and the guy who wrote it, I should also mention, he's a Canadian, originally from Canada, and he was involved in like the Reform Party back in the 90s. Maybe that's not too big a surprise.
It's like our number one export.
Yeah.
Right-wing blowhards.
Robert, as I believe you know, on this show, we like to duly note things. What would you like to note, Julie, today?
Okay, so my thing is a story from December 3rd, which has received surprisingly little attention in the press, from the CBC via the Canadian press. Global Affairs confirms 8th Canadian dead since the start of the Israel-Hamas war. This is a Canadian who was killed in Lebanon. Now, fast forward to another story from later in December, and you see another report by Canadian press where they're talking about all the victims who died in Israel who were killed by Hamas. They're all named and a bio is given of them. And then there's just a little note at the bottom that an 8th Canadian was killed in Lebanon. And what I guess I would duly note is that in all this time, nobody has found out that person's name. Nobody's reported on them. Nobody's interviewed their family. And we don't know if Canada has issued a note to Israel, said they're mad, give them an angry post-it under the table during the minister's visit. We don't know anything that's happened. It's showing the scale of the failure of Canada's media in reporting on this issue. And it's a failure that maybe should duly be noted by certain media watchdogs.
Thank you. Duly noted.
The sports website Deadspin has been sold and its entire staff cut in the process. Deadspin was launched in 2005 as part of Gawker. Deadspin's next owner would be Univision in 2016, sold from there to Geo Media in 2019, which takes us to today, sold to a media startup, Lineup Publishing. Deciding to cut all staff and start fresh with a new editorial team and new vision.
Deadspin is dead. Again, after a tumultuous several years, or tumultuous decade, really, the sports journalism website that was originally part of the Gawker media empire has once again changed hands, peeled away from its ex-Gawker brethren, and has now been sold to Lineup Publishing, and all the staff were let go. So, what is Lineup Publishing? Well, according to its homepage, it is engaging brands with heaps of character. Those brands include some of the biggest websites out there, ones you visit every day. No, not really. The only brand known to be associated with it so far is Deadspin. Otherwise, it's something of a mystery seemingly based in Malta. Or as 404 Media managed to figure out, Deadspin is becoming a gambling referral site. It's not yet clear what that will mean in practice, but going by previous comments from one of the people behind Lineup Publishing, it'll likely involve converting the site into a husk populated with junk content that mostly exists to funnel along users to a gambling website. And, you know, and that's not too far removed from a key part of the plan that NordStar had for the Toronto Star back when they purchased the Star in 2020 to use the property to drive traffic to and interest in a new online casino and sportsbook called North Star Gaming. Except that didn't really work out as a revenue model, and the uneasy partnership behind NordStar fell apart. But, you know, still, next to newsletters and today's paper at the top of the Toronto Star website is a link to NordStar Bets. So where am I going with this? Well, it's all very easy to laugh at, and I kind of did and have and will continue to. But our editor, Karen, pointed out something that I actually wasn't aware of. For a lot of community broadcasting in Canada, including Indigenous broadcasting, and particularly for Indigenous radio, bingo has been and continues to be a significant source of funding.
Good evening and welcome to another session of CKON Radio Bingo.
Hey, Radio Bingo family. Don't forget, we're firing up the fall-winter schedule.
Segun, I'm Da Sanage, phone operator for your Radio Bingo. Tune in this week for your chance to win a free bingo package.
15 lucky winners will win $1,000 each.
I-28, Crazy T. I-28, on your 9-2-bill card. B-10. B-10.
So, for a lot of reasons, that's not quite the same thing that Lineup will do with Deadspin or that Nordstar did with Horstar, but it honestly never occurred to me that games of chance have proven to be a viable, even long-term revenue source for at least some Canadian media. Robert, just how blinkered is it of me to have not been aware of this?
I don't think it's that big a blinker that's preventing you from seeing it. I mean, this stuff is flying under the radar. Native culture, everything's about gambling. Like two or three times a day, you get some message saying, join this 50-50 or buy one of these playing cards to help raise money for X, Y, or Z. That's just a real, real common native, regular native person way of raising money. That was some lame-ass bingo calling, just as a criticism there, though. If you're a native kid, you spent a lot of time in bingo halls, and that was just not good bingo calling.
I can't say I'm especially familiar with it beyond... Very middle-class white person, beyond the play of the Rez Sisters.
Wait, do middle-class white people not know what bingo is? Like, do you not go to bingo when you're a kid?
Well, I know what bingo is. Like, I'm aware of it, but I guess in terms of there being a particular connection to Native culture in Canada, as someone who lives in a city that has very few Indigenous people, it's actually not something that has ever... I only know through theater about it.
Oh, do you know why? Because you don't go to church. Because that's where they all are. The bingos are in church basements. That makes sense.
Weirdly, not a lot appears to have been written about this as the media funding via bingo. Bingo is a revenue source in terms of it being a larger phenomenon or trend. But pretty much every single study of Indigenous broadcasting in Canada, both government and academic, does make a point of mentioning that for many stations, bingo is a significant source of revenue. The proportions don't tend to offer any numbers or stats or even an indication that it's ever been a subject of someone's research. But I mean, like a 2019 report on Indigenous radio for the Canadian Commission for UNESCO said, one station explained that they have been rejected for government grants because the station makes, quote, too much money with their bingo fundraisers. One of the few overviews was actually a Globe article by Dave McGinn from 3 years ago, which was about radio bingo more generally, not specifically Indigenous, but, you know, radio bingo sees a surge in interest during pandemic in small towns. It explains, you know, most stations sell cards for $5 or $6, typically offer prizes between $100 and $1,000. But, you know, the Aboriginal Multimedia Society of Alberta has run weekly bingo games on two of its stations since 1996. And during the pandemic, a couple of their jackpots topped out at $50,000. The head of that organization, Bert Crowfoot, told the Senate committee back in November of 2022 that all of our stations are in the black financially, and traditional Indigenous radio bingo pays for most of our distribution expansion. I know that when the Star first, they started musing about going into the gambling thing. I mean, the first thing I did was go back and pull up like all, you know, old headlines from front pages about gambling addiction and about, you know, the problems that a new casino in Toronto could cause and the whole thing with casinos and certainly online gambling is that necessarily a disproportionate proportion of the people who use it, or evenly any proportion, but a disproportionate portion are people who are addicted and people who can least afford to lose that money and gamble away that money. Would there or ought there to be similar ethical concerns with bingo, where the stakes seem to be somewhat smaller, or at least harder to lose a lot of money at one time?
Bingo addiction is a real thing. My grandma would call our house every morning. She'd do a round of calling all her kids. And she wouldn't say hello. She would just say, got any money, like that, in that tone, to see if she could raise some money to go to bingo, because she had blown her pension check on it by the end of the first week. It's a real addiction.
How does one play bingo on the radio? Like, how does that work?
It's like Keno. They just call, you have a card, they call numbers, and then I guess you call in.
Oh, okay. So, they sell the cards from the stations. I don't know, I guess, how they're actually distributed, and then... they call them on and then just mark it off. And then when you have them all, you call in and...
I suppose so. Yeah. I've never done it. I didn't know that was that big a deal. But I mean, that's really tied up to Native culture, to pan-Indian culture in this country. That type of gambling and that type of, you know, fundraising. I can't really see like the Globe and Mail doing it.
I mean, they do. They have cruises. Have you ever looked into the Globe and Mail cruises?
Yeah, or a golf tournament. That seems more their speed.
Yeah, I don't think it's weird, because it's not something that I even think could or would be replicated by media in other contexts. But it is, once again, it just blows my mind that this has been a viable thing for so long. It does make me wonder what else is possible. I mean, or even how old this was. Like, I found a reference back to the mid-80s, about, I guess, like 85, almost 40 years ago, where there was this sort of pirate network of TV stations in northern Ontario covering areas that either were only served by the CBC or weren't even served by the CBC at all. And so they were just playing tapes, that stuff they taped off of CBC, CTV, and Global, and they were funding themselves via bingo. So it seems to go back at least that far, but it just, I wish I had some more definitive numbers to offer. It seems that no one has ever actually researched this as some sort of larger phenomenon.
I guess what it shows is that if you want your media to survive, you really need to find solutions within your own culture to get it to last. So the native solution, of course, is just to hit up that kind of gambling. The non-native solution might be, I don't know, maybe all the big media companies should get into real estate.
Mm.
House flipping.
That would make sense as a Globe thing. Yeah, as you said, like the Globe. I mean, in some ways, some of the more successful media does. Like the Globe has cruises, Extra has cruising. Extra published by Extra Daily Extra. It used to be a newspaper,
in
Toronto.
Yeah.
But it's still a website that does original journalism and commentary and reporting. Owned by Pink Triangle Press, and their revenue source is primarily Squirt.org, which is a cruising website and app, subscription-based, sort of like a subscription-based Grindr, but also has like specifically lists of like spots to cruise, or we've talked on the show before, there's Spacing magazine, which is, sells buttons and it sells Toronto-themed merchandise, not just Spacing merchandise, but Toronto-themed merchandise, or like the Walrus, which has not just annual gala but annual auctions. Last year, they auctioned off things like an organ transplant sit-in, which went to an anonymous bidder for 50.
Sorry, what?
An organ transplant sit-in.
Like you could watch an organ transplant?
Yes, although if you read the fine print, you discover it looks more like you're watching them as they tune up an organ that is about to be transplanted. So I don't think it sounds like, at first I thought like, oh, you actually get to see it being put in someone, but it sounds like you get to see them with it. And get it ready to be put in someone.
That's a shame. I'd love to see. They go into the belly button now. I'd love to see how that works.
Yeah, for $55. Well, at least last year went for $5,500, though they said it was a $7,500 value. Last year, also an organizational crisis plan by Navigator, which someone got for $5,000, apparently a $20,000 value.
Wow. I would love that crisis thing from Navigator. Like, I would just go and cause drama just for it, to use it.
So, I mean, yeah, know your audience.
And you know what? So put the Deadspin in that context. I mean, what are you watching sports for? I mean, I guess a lot of people, it's like hometown pride, but a lot of other people is gambling. So it does seem like a good cultural fit there, doesn't it?
Yeah, maybe actually getting in and knowing your audience and what you can offer them.
So what would the Canadaland version be? I assume some sort of spritzer, some alcoholic spritzer.
We had a beer a few years ago. There was not. It was a Candleland sour. I mean, just a Jesse Brown dunk tank at this point would be nice. I think we'd all be in favor of that. We have to specify no headshots.
So, what would be appropriate for the CBC
to make up revenue?
How are you going to raise money for the CBC if Poiliev cuts it? I mean, what is the CBC about? I mean, it's boring as hell. Oh, sedatives. You could use it as a damn sedative for people who are having trouble getting to sleep.
So you could sell doses of it?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is like what you see. The CBC is, after a lot of editing, it's like that's just the good stuff. So they must be sitting on some prime sedative content. So for insomniacs, I think that'd be wonderful. You know, we are always looking at night for like something to listen to, some white noise, and that'd be perfect.
That's Shortcuts for this week. Thanks for joining me, Robert.
Thank you.
People can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com, where they can complain about how quickly I'm speaking, or you can follow me on Blue Sky. Where can people find you, Robert?
You could find me in the near future on Canadaland at a series called Pretendians.
Cool. It's coming out this spring. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production coordinator is Andre Prue. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.